Dear friends, we've read a portion of the Gospel according to St. John. It is in this portion the Feast of the Tabernacles. It just had been the Day of Atonement, in which Israel confessed that sins needed to be forgiven, and in which was called upon the name of the Lord, if you please him, grant forgiveness and mercy. And immediately after this Day of Atonement, there was always that Feast of Tabernacles, which lasted for 7 days. It was called Great Feast. And people in Israel always said, if you do not keep the Feast of Tabernacles, you do not really know what is happiness, gladness. People lived in tabernacles in tents for those 7 days, and remember that they have lived in tabernacles during the journey through the wilderness. And the Lord brought them out of the land of Egypt and guided them through the wilderness and to Canaan, land flowing milk and honey. It was also in those days Feast of the Harvest, we should say nowadays Thanksgiving's Day. Thanksgiving, it's the Thanksgiving days in the days of Israel. Feast of the Harvest, in which also the grapes were harvested. So the Feast of the Wine. Well, there should be holy gladness and holy joy in Israel. We easily can imagine what happens when people are together in these kinds of feasts, or the wine feast. We should not surprise that instead of holy joy, it was many times unholy joy. Or to say, when they did drink from new wine, reverently speaking, the brakes went off. You can imagine that. We are together in a wedding party. I'm not in a really buff Christian school in auditorium, because there should not be drink. But somewhere else. And the labor becomes a day great, and the happiness and gladness seems to be because of wine and the drink. Sometimes in our bodies, where does it end up? Easily speaking, not about the most proper things. Easily speaking, jokes, dirty jokes, or other things. I mean, also in the days of the Feast of the Tabernacle, in the days of the Lord Jesus, this was going on, and a serious problem. Our text, this portion, is speaking about a woman who crossed the lines, the borders set by the word of God, and she was caught in adultery. Amidst of that Feast of the Wine, the Feast of the Tabernacles, maybe, is that the reason that we read that Jesus went unto the Mount of Olives? Because of kind of type of happiness and gladness, which was unholy gladness. The following morning, the Lord Jesus came back, and then it is that the Pharisees and the scribes, they came to him with a woman caught in adultery. She was not an older lady. She was, so to say, not one of the decently married women. No, she was engaged. do you know that means I do not read that in John 8? Well, if you know your Bible a little bit, then you know also what is written down in Deuteronomy 20. When a married woman was caught in adultery, she should not be stoned, but she should be strangled. But when a girl, before a marriage, engaged, or maybe dating, now she promised to be faithful to her friend, was caught in adultery, she should be stoned. What happened in that night? Was she intoxicated? Did she drink too much? She sinned. She fell into sin. And the consequences were that she was caught. We also know that many times those kinds of sins were committed around the temple itself. In one of the rooms of the holy places, around the temple. She was caught, and the Pharisees, who always wanted to maintain the law, who were keepers of the law, together with the scribes, brought her into the Lord Jesus to tempt him. They wanted to know what the Lord Jesus would answer. What shall we do with her? Jesus knew she deserved. They knew it themselves as well. And that young lady, she knew it also. But then it seems to be strange that the Lord Jesus did not answer any word. He was just writing in the dust. He did not answer, why not? Because he knew that they were tempting him. That they were trying to catch the Lord Jesus in his answer. And to accuse him. And to speak evil of him. There we have the reason that he did not answer Pharisees and scribes. And when they wanted to have an answer, he only said, whom of you is without sin, may cast the first stone at her. Cast the first stone. So Jesus, as to say, he became, instead of the accused, the accuser. He turned things around. And he actually accused the Pharisees and the scribes that they themselves were not without sin either. Now we see that fruit they left from the oldest to the youngest. Why was that? Because of their conscience conviction. Didn't Jesus say once, whosoever looketh at a woman to desire her, to commit adultery with her, thus already committed adultery? And they knew that very well because of their conscience convictions. But my dear friends, there was no one of them, of the leaders of Israel, who were actually misleaders and deceivers. There was no one of them. About them before the Lord to confess their sins, to confess, Lord, I am the guilty one, to confess, Lord, I have done that which is evil in thy sight. Thus they left, from the oldest to the youngest. And when the Lord Jesus then looks up and sees her alone, she didn't run away either. There is the gate to one inner self. He said, did no one accuse you? I will not do either. Go to your house and do not sin anymore. This other sins. Just briefly this night, But dear friends, that is what we need. Soul-saving convictions. The Lord himself reproves sin. Also against the seventh commandment. It's not that long ago that we thought about it in church. And maybe we still remember that. In which circumstances we can sin against the seventh commandment. And how we can do that with our words, blessing God, with our way of looking, with our deeds. We need to become the guilty ones tonight, each and every one of us. No? We should not look to others of whom we know that. It is so necessary that we learn to look inwardly in our heart. We may become the guilty one ourselves. If we learn to flee to the inner chamber, if we learn to be willing to confess our guilt, our sin, that it may become true. I am the greatest chief of the sinners. We learn to see, experience our sin, to hate our sin, that we learn to flee from sin. Then it is no question whether we should take a good filter at home. Hear anymore that people say, well, I do not need such a filter. Such a person does not know himself at all, herself at all. Such a person is deceiving himself. Such a person is open to all temptations. Such a person is open to all wickedness. There's such a good connection in our heart to all sins, so we should keep as much as possible the door closed. And we above all need soul-saving grace. We need open eyes. We need an inner. We need a broken heart. We need a contrite spirit. We need to become the guilty ones. We need to become as this young girl. As this young girl. Caught in adultery. We should become such a one. Who only can cry out, "The Lord, be merciful to me, the sinner." She becomes such. The Lord is to hate sin. The law of God's commandments, not only the first and the tenth, but also the seventh commandment. And it is true. What the Lord said, "He that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her." Still, that does not mean that we can sin, for we never are without sin, so it's not that big deal. It is. Sin against the seventh commandment ruins a person, ruins his life. Ruins his marriage, ruins his family life, ruins everything. Destroying. Therefore, we should, as much as possible, kneel down in a praying way, flee from us. Ask the Lord for mercy, supplicating for his help. Call upon his name. he might be mindful. That he will remember us in his mercy. Friends, it is for sure an important topic which we have to consider tonight. I'm glad you're all here. Do we need an only praying heart and a praying life? May the Lord remember us in this way and make room for Christ in this way. He will not condemn either. That is the greatest wonder. That has been the greatest wonder for this young lady. And that will be the greatest wonder in the life of God's church. That though I deserve to be condemned, to be judged, to be slain, to be swept away with the vision of destruction, the Lord is that mindful. And that he is ready and willing to forgive, even David, after receiving grief, Solomon, and this young lady, and each and every one of us struggles with the sin against the seventh commandment, but in the right way to his own. Our salvation. So be it.
PowerPoint. All right, thank you everyone for being here this evening. Just briefly, for those of you who are wondering why I am giving this specific presentation, as many of you will know, I work for a pro-life organization, and several years ago, a pastor in Calgary asked me why I thought abortion was extremely prevalent in our culture. And I said, well, the very simple answer to that question is that people are killing babies so that they can have sex whenever they want. Be very blunt. He said, could you put that into a full-length presentation and present it to the youth of my church? So I first presented there, and then I was asked to give it at the RCNA school in Chilliwack, and since then I've ended up giving this particular presentation, which I gave at Rehoboth last year, quite a few times. So that's just a little bit of the background on why I'm giving this particular presentation. So to start off, a few years ago, a professor named Chap Clark decided to do a bit of research into what many of you may have heard called the hookup culture. Most statistics and much polling now tells us that over half of adolescents in high school are sexually active. Obviously, that number is lower in Christian schools, but in public schools, that number seems to be rising by the year. Chap Clark wasn't really satisfied with just seeing these polling numbers and just seeing these statistics. So he decided to do a bit more research to find out the story behind those numbers. And what he found surprised even him. He found this following. This is from his report. Quote, I was surprised to realize that for most mid-adolescents, the issue of sex has lost its mystique and has become almost commonplace. They have been conditioned to expect so much from sex and have been so tainted by overexposure that, as one student told me, sex is a game and a toy, nothing more. Now, because of how our culture treats sex, this attitude is becoming increasingly prevalent in Europe and across North America. Now, I don't think I need to tell you that it's very difficult for Christians, and especially young Christians in today's culture, to adhere to the laws that Christianity sets forth, especially the laws on sexuality. Because since the late 1960s and the early 1970s, sex has been essentially everywhere in our culture. The left-wing culture decided that they were going to embrace an idea called free love, which was essentially that everybody could do whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted. And very quickly, the popular culture adopted all of those things. first was music. Now, a lot of people say that there's a form of music now that they listen to called Christian rock and roll. Now, to show how ridiculous that concept is, many people don't realize that the term rock and roll itself comes from describing two people having sex in a car outside of a concert. This type of music was literally created just to glorify sex, which is why it's used generally in conjunction with sex, drugs, and rock and roll. So first music happened, and now as we see, you can't go anywhere in our culture without hearing this music, whether it be the mall, whether it be out of the car next to you, whether it be at any public place in general. So the point here being that even if we are not consuming these things directly, even if we don't have television in our homes, even if we're not listening to this music in our cars, it's kind of like secondhand smoke. You don't actually have to be smoking to catch it. In our culture, it's now everywhere. Most modern music genres are at this point specifically dedicated to promoting these types of things because our culture realized something very, very simple, and that is that sex sells. And they use sex to sell everything at this point, which means that if you're watching television, even if you're just watching the news, they're using sex to sell everything from cars to lotion products. So in other words, you don't actually have to be directly consuming what our culture is producing to be affected by this, which is why I think that these topics are important for everybody to take a look at. All of popular culture is essentially selling one major idea now. It's not just that sex should be casual, that sex is glamorous, or that sex has no consequences. The number one lie it's selling is that sex isn't a big deal. Hookup culture, meaning you can hook up with whoever you want, whenever you want, and you won't actually have to suffer real-world consequences for doing that. To give you one example, when I was in university, I heard one guy say to another, he said, "Guys these days have no excuse for not having sex because music and TV have done half the job for us." Even people that are out in the external culture recognize that the culture assists them in doing whatever they want. So the main question that we have to address first is sex actually a big deal? Because one attitude we find increasingly creeping into Christian culture across North America, and what proves this is that all the stats and all the polling coming out now say that Christians, by and large, are having sex outside of marriage at the same rate as the rest of the population. Christians are now consuming porn at the same rate as the rest of the population, and perhaps most horrifyingly, for the most part, Christians are having abortions at the same rate as the rest of the population as well. I'd like to think our communities are somewhat insulated from that, but at the same time, this polling data I still think is quite shocking. And one of the reasons for this is that people don't think sex is a big deal anymore. Sure, they think that sex is technically sinful, but they also think that lying is sinful, disobeying your parents and getting home late for curfew is sinful. You can even make a case of something like speeding is sinful. And thus, sex has been taken out of the realm of the sacred, and it's just shifted into this long list of other things that we can't do. It gets ignored, and people get careless with how it goes. However, what most people in our culture have completely forgotten, we all knew this about 50 years ago, but since then, our culture has completely forgotten this. If you have sex outside of marriage, especially before marriage, especially with multiple partners or using pornography, the impact generally will be extremely drastic. Because what we don't realize is that the rules that were given to us in the Bible aren't simply a list of arbitrary rules that are put there just to restrict us. Those rules were put there by a creator who, since he both created us and created sexuality, knows infinitely better than we do how it works and how it's supposed to function. For the last 50 years, our culture has decided that we know better than God how sexuality functions, that we know better than God how the human body functions, and therefore we can do whatever we want in complete defiance of the natural order that He has created and that we are all subject to by virtue of being part of our creation. Even though, very simply, these rules were put in place to protect us from ourselves. And I'll give you one really casual example that highlights that point. Many people read through books of Leviticus and Deuteronomy and they look at the endless lists of things that the Israelites weren't allowed to do and wonder why God imposed so many rules on the Israelites. Well, as scientists do increasing research today, they've discovered that with the refrigeration techniques that were available at that time, and with the types of foods listed, for example, shellfish and pork, if the Israelites had eaten that food at that time, unrefrigerated, many of them would have gotten sick and died. So what we discover here is that these rules weren't put in place for some arbitrary or random reason. These rules were put in place very specifically by God to protect his people, the Israelites, from horrible natural consequences that would impact them in a very real-world physical way if they disobeyed those commandments. And we'll see very shortly that those rules also apply quite drastically to sexuality as well. Now, I don't want anybody to get the impression from this presentation that sex is an extremely negative thing, and that we should always say that any discussions about this are wrong. Sex is obviously a gift that was created by God very specifically for within marriage with one man and one woman, and it was created in paradise. So sex is an extremely positive thing, but it's been so completely mangled, destroyed, and removed from the natural order by the culture at large that we're now forced to take a look at consequences that would have been unthinkable only two generations ago. So first, physical consequences. And I'm going to divide these consequences into three separate categories. First being physical consequences, because those are the most obvious. Second will be psychological consequences, or the effect on the mind. And third will be spiritual consequences, where I'll recap what I said about pornography the previous time. Now, this information, once again, I think is extremely shocking, because when I first started doing research for this presentation, it very much shocked me. One of the first things that jumped out at me was that most people generally think that the common cold is the most common virus in North America. And in the early 1960s, if you guessed that the common cold was the most common virus, you would have been absolutely correct. However, since the sexual revolution of the late 60s and early 70s, now sexually transmitted diseases are the most common virus in North America. This is according to the Center for Disease Control. Just as a side note, if you ever read about the hookup culture in newspapers or magazines, or you see it in documentaries, it'll be referred to now in the last 2 years as STIs, and that stands for sexually transmitted infections. And the reason they're calling it sexually transmitted infections now is because the promiscuity culture has taken over so pervasively that medical professionals don't want to call it a disease anymore, because disease has a stigma to it. So they want to destigmatize diseases that are caught through promiscuity by calling it something different, because an infection apparently sounds much easier to treat than a disease does. Now, when we take a look at sexually transmitted diseases throughout history, in 1960, there were only two major STDs that North Americans generally had to worry about. And those two diseases were gonorrhea and syphilis. I think it's important to note, there were only two of these diseases. However, As I mentioned before, in the late 60s and early 70s, the sexual revolution took place, and people decided to completely disregard the natural order God had placed on sex. And when that happened, the consequences were not just spiritual, they were very, very physical. Today, in 2013, and this number is literally growing by the month, there are 25 categories of sexually transmitted disease. We didn't go from two diseases to 25 diseases, we went from two diseases to 25 separate categories of diseases, which means that the explosion and the mutation of new diseases as the result of abandoning God's order is absolutely incredible. Scientists have no idea how to combat this new scourge. Our culture has literally created new diseases based on sinful behavior, and the worst part of it is this behavior continues to be perpetuated in the public schools. It came out today on the radio, actually, in London. New sex education is being introduced in the schools. That's basically telling kids that all of this stuff is okay, when it's transparently obvious by any literate human being that's reading any scientific study being produced that this type of activity is resulting in a cultural crisis that we're going to have to deal with sooner rather than later. Now, just to give you a few examples of how diseases have mutated and spread, most people in the room have probably heard of the disease herpes. Herpes is an incurable sexual disease, and you can contract it the very first time you engage in a sexual encounter. One sexual encounter, and herpes would be with you for the rest of your life. But what most people don't realize is that herpes now comes in 8 separate strains, and you can contact anywhere between 1 and all eight of these strains in one sexual encounter. The same thing with the sexually transmitted disease hepatitis. Many people would have heard of this one because often when we're traveling to a new place, people have to get shots for hepatitis B. Now, it used to be just hepatitis B, but once again, because of a culture of promiscuity, this disease has mutated, mutated, and mutated, and now we have hepatitis A, B, C, D, E, F, and G. And the number is probably going to continue to go up. Today in 2013, and these stats are from last year, approximately 1 in 4 high school students will graduate with a sexually transmitted disease. The vast majority of these high school students will literally have no idea that they even have one, because the vast majority of high school students think sex isn't a big deal, and the vast majority of high school students aren't going out and getting actually tested for STDs. 4 out of every 10 girls today in the United States and Canada will contract a sexually transmitted disease the very first time they have sex. And as we've seen, a lot of these diseases are with you for life. So if they're losing their virginity at age 13, 14, 15, and 16 in the public school system, they will contract a disease that will affect their entire future as early as that age. And it actually gets quite worse. There are studies that were just released by the Canadian government examining the single most common sexually transmitted disease today. It's a disease called human papillomavirus, or HPV. HPV is the way that it's commonly known in the culture. And there are now 40 separate strains of HPV. Think about just for a moment how fast these diseases are mutating. This started around 1965 to 1969. We're only here in 2013, and these diseases are mutating faster than scientists can actually discover that they're there. HPV is so common in Canada at this point that the government of Canada says that every promiscuous male and female is likely to contract HPV at one point or another during their life. Now, why is this a problem? HPV is generally considered to be pretty easy to get rid of, except there's a catch. HPV can cause cervical cancer among women, as well as 4 other types of cancer in women and 2 types of cancer in men. The big problem with this is it's impossible to trace. There is no test that's yet been developed to find out if you have HPV. If you go in and get tested, nobody will be able to figure out whether you have it or not, because the disease is still untraceable. One scientist said that the only way they can trace how fast HPV is spreading at this point is how fast girls die from cervical cancer from HPV. They're literally having to tally up the bodies to find out how fast this goes, and this is so common that every sexually active male or female, according to the Canadian government, will contract this at one point during their lifetime. So this is extraordinarily widespread. It makes other pandemics throughout human history look extraordinarily small and insignificant. Let me put the problem into somewhat of a perspective for you. Every day in the United States, 1,500 people will die from cancer. 2,600 people will die from a heart-related illness like a heart attack or a stroke. But every day, more than 50,000 people will contract a sexually transmitted disease. That's not counting the ones we can't detect, like HPV, which are becoming increasingly prevalent. You've heard probably a lot about the healthcare debate in the United States, where they're debating whether or not the government should be paying for healthcare. Well, direct medical costs in the United States associated with sexually transmitted diseases is right now at $13 billion a year. Not $13 million, $13 billion a year. And this is purely brought about by behavior that could easily be curbed and stopped. 19 million people every year, then, according to statistics released 2 years ago, are contracting a sexually transmitted disease. If you think about it, there's only 300 million people in the entire United States. There's only 33 million people in all of Canada. It means diseases are progressing so fast that it's conceivable that in the future, almost everybody will have been impacted at some point. Now, some of you may be thinking, well, for most STDs, there are cures and there are medications, and even the incurable diseases, like herpes, can be controlled with medication. And that's true for a lot of them, but not for all of them. I'm sure everybody here in this room has heard of AIDS. Now, 20 years ago, AIDS was considered to be very specifically a problem that afflicted the homosexual community. Once again, you see what happens when you defy the natural order God has placed on sex. Devastating physical consequences result. But at this point, due to widespread promiscuity, it's actually increasingly affecting heterosexuals as well. And recently in Canada, in Vancouver a year ago in fact, there are people being arrested and put in jail on manslaughter and murder charges because they didn't tell the partner they were having sex with that they were HIV positive. And as the result of this, their partner actually died of AIDS. Which means that this problem is literally lethal on a number of different levels. But people are so selfish and people are so focused on doing exactly what they want that they don't even care. And people are dying as a result of this. Again, I think it's important to note that God gives us many blessings. We got to keep a few blessings after the fall in paradise, but these blessings turn into a curse very quickly if they're removed from the natural order and twisted. Incidentally, I want to make one more point. What I often get when I'm talking to public school kids is they say, well, condoms prevent sexually transmitted diseases. And this is probably the most laughable lie that's ever been sold by the left-wing sexual revolutionaries to young people. One, if you look at the statistics I just gave you, how many STDs are condoms actually producing? The left wing and the public school system are throwing handfuls of condoms at kids, and they're still contracting STDs like crazy, which means just by looking at the numbers, we know it's not working. But furthermore, Dr. Thomas Fitch from the United States, who ran the Center for Disease Control several years ago, he was such an advocate of handing out condoms, they called him the Condom King. And when they caught him in an interview, he said he admitted that condoms will rarely, if ever, prevent STDs. So when people start talking about that type of thing, there is no escape from the physical consequences of these sins. There is no such thing as consequence-free sex outside of marriage. There's no such thing. It's a complete myth that was invented in the late 60s, and it's done more to damage our culture and kill preborn babies than anything else. Sexually transmitted diseases, even the ones that are easy to get rid of, are no picnic either. Genital warts is one of the most common sexually transmitted diseases, with most high school boys contracting them at one point. In a pamphlet that was used to raise awareness about it, this is how they described it. Quote, if you get genital warts, you're going to start growing warts in your genital area. They grow on top of each other, and they'll begin to form nodules and clusters that look like broccoli. They're called condyloma. They make it painful to sit, to walk, and to move. And they're the most painful when they're being removed. So even the diseases that are easily cured are by no means easy to deal with. Now here's something else that often surprises people. When people are engaging in casual sex, even if they think that they're just sleeping with the person that they're dating at the moment, they think they're only having sex with one person. But Dr. Everett Koop, who was the Surgeon General of the United States for quite a few years under the President Ronald Reagan, pointed out otherwise. And he wrote, quote, when you have sex with somebody, you are having sex with everyone they have had sex with for the last 10 years, and everyone they and their partners have had sex with for the last 10 years. This is a biological reality. You become linked to all these different people. And I have a graph that illustrates that point. As you can see, if it's one person and one person inside of marriage, you're exposed to exactly one other person. This shouldn't be surprising. But the more people you expose yourself to, the more people are exposed to, and the more that number goes up, from 2 to 3, 3 to 7, 4 to 15. By the time that people have had 12 sexual partners, which is incidentally one away from the national average in Canada, they've actually been sexually exposed to 4,095 different people. So people think they're being exclusive by only having sex with one person in the moment. But if you look at these statistics, and if you look at how it was explained by the former US Surgeon General, the bedroom gets crowded pretty quickly. Now, the final physical consequence of sex is one that I shouldn't even have to bring up, but our culture has gone so completely insane on these issues that it's still one that I have to address, and that I have to address as part of my work very regularly. And that is very simple. Pregnancy. Now, it seems sort of ludicrous that we would have to point out that sex often results in pregnancy, but for some reason, when people decided that recreational sex was this new thing, they forgot that they don't have recreational organs, they only have reproductive organs. And you would be absolutely shocked if you realized how foolish people are on this issue. I debate abortion a lot on university campuses. And often I get guys coming up to me and saying, well, I don't know how that happened. I'm like, well, I think you do. If you thought about it, you would know exactly how that happened, because you can't engage in the act of human reproduction and then pretend to be surprised when a human being is created as the result of that action. But our culture has separated sex and childbearing to such a degree that people are literally surprised when they get their girlfriends pregnant. If you have sex outside of marriage, there's a very good chance that you won't be ready for a baby. If you're not ready for a baby, two horrible things happen, and these two things have been a corollary of the sexual revolution that have wildly impacted our culture. One is the fact that the vast majority at this point of children are being raised in single homes. Children are either being born to single parents or their parents are splitting, but this is having an enormous impact on the next generation growing up because they don't have two parents. They don't have a mother, they don't have a father, they don't have that balance, and that impacts them profoundly and it impacts them psychologically. And the second one I referenced earlier is the fact that right now, most unwanted babies are destroyed through abortion. Over 1.2 million preborn children are decapitated, dismembered, and disemboweled every single year in the United States based on this whole idea of sexual freedom. In Canada, that's 266 babies every single day, over 100,000 babies every single year. People often look at abortion and they say abortion is child sacrifice, but it's actually in some ways even worse. In biblical times, especially if you read about child sacrifice in the book of Jeremiah, the heathens sacrificed their children to false gods because it was the most valuable thing they had to offer to their idols. We throw our children away in the trash because they mean nothing to us in our culture. That, I would argue, is much, much worse. And we're supposed to be considered a Christian civilization, but we're engaging in barbarism on a scale that's never before seen in all of human history. We're talking 42 million babies killed every single year. For the most part, to my knowledge, it's not a problem in our churches, but abortion does happen sometimes in our churches. I've gotten phone calls from girls whose boyfriends got them pregnant and wanted to take their girlfriend down to the abortion clinic because, of course, they don't want their parents, her parents to find out. They don't want the church to find out. It's going to be embarrassing. There's 7 clinics in downtown Toronto. There's 6 in Vancouver. It's a short hour drive to go and get the problem taken care of, and nobody needs to know about it. One of our ministers here in the Netherlands Reformed congregation actually preached on this, and he compared it directly to the sin of David and Bathsheba, murder to cover up sexual sin. Because when David slept with Bathsheba, in order to cover up his sin with her, he killed her husband. Now, in order to cover up sexual sin, we're sometimes prone to kill our own children. I want to address one more issue that's corollary to abortion and is extremely prevalent in our culture today. Now, many people think the birth control pill can't cause abortions. Many people talk to their doctors who tell them the birth control pill doesn't cause abortions. There is no scientific study, there is no doctor who will be able to honestly tell you that there is no chance it will cause abortions. There's no such thing as a birth control pill that can't kill a baby. And you don't have to take my word for it. I got a study that was performed by several Reformed nurses where they discussed the Christian ethics surrounding the birth control pill. And I'm going to read this from the paper, quote, word for word. I'm going to quote it. Quote, most of us wouldn't think of taking the morning after pill. The morning after pill, of course, being a pill that many women take after having sex to hopefully prevent this new embryo from implanting, and hopefully that baby will be flushed out and die instead. But the birth control pill is the same combination of medications that is found in birth control pills and uses the exact same 3 ways of action to prevent pregnancy that the pill does. In fact, in many cases, the morning after pill is literally punched out of a birth control pill package and dispensed in a vial with different directions, but it remains the same medication women all the world over use to prevent pregnancy on a month-to-month basis, albeit simply a higher dose. So what they're saying here is the birth control pill, with the dosage upped a little bit, is the exact same thing that people use to take afterwards to try to kill the baby. In more detail, they continue, hormonal contraception does 3 things. One, it prevents ovulation from occurring so that no egg can be fertilized, so preventing pregnancy. 2, it prevents conception by thickening the cervical mucus to prevent sperm from reaching the egg in case ovulation doesn't take place. So two, also preventing pregnancy. But three, it thins the lining of the uterus so that a newly conceived human embryo, often referred to as the fertilized egg, will be unable to implant. In other words, this human being will be flushed out at the next menstrual cycle, and that human being will die. Quote, how is this possible? Ovulation can take place while using hormonal contraception. Anytime ovulation takes place, there is a possibility of conception and then a possibility of pregnancy. We know birth control pills fail, as in a woman gets pregnant while taking them, at a rate of 3 out of every 100 women per year. Some of these pregnancies are due to, quote, human error, that is, not taking them exactly as prescribed or not taking them on time. However, in women taking the pill perfectly, pregnancy can still happen. So what does that tell us? This means that all three methods of actions we have just described to you for the pill have failed, and the baby had to pass three barriers. What is unknown to us is how often do the first two mechanisms fail, and the last mechanism, the mechanism that kills a human life, happen? How then can pro-life women in good conscience be taking medication to prevent pregnancy that can also terminate life, end quote? The simple answer to that question is that from a pro-life perspective, we can't do that. Because taking any type of medication that threatens human life defies God's command to respect all life and to uphold the sanctity of all life. So that finishes the first set of consequences of the sexual revolution and of having sex outside of marriage. The second set is psychological and emotional consequences. Now, as I referenced at the beginning of the presentation, many people that think that sex is simply not a big deal. But psychologists are now explaining to us that it's very much otherwise. Many people think today that they can have casual sex with a number of different partners, especially early on in their teens or perhaps when they're in university, and then they can find the girl they want to marry, find the guy they want to marry, settle down, and forget any of that ever happened. There's often an attitude that boys will be boys, and let's just let that go on. But the simple fact is that because God created us to be monogamous, one man and one woman, as he created Eve in the Bible, sex outside of marriage, especially with multiple partners, does have a very real impact on your future relationships. Now, many of you have probably heard of this concept that's very famous in classical literature and also very famous in classical poetry of never being able to forget your first love. Now, it's worded quite differently depending on which literature that you read, but the consensus generally is that that's most difficult. Well, it's not just a literary device, it's not just a way of speaking, it's actually a biological and psychological reality. Sexual contact releases powerful chemicals in the brain called neurotransmitters. These chemicals will trigger immediate sensations, but they also do far more. I'm going to read from a scientist who explained in one book why couples who stay monogamous or only ever have sex with each other have far more successful marriages. Quote, when two people touch each other in a meaningful way, oxytocin is released into the woman's brain. This oxytocin then does two things. It increases a woman's desire for more touch and causes bonding of the woman to the man she's been spending time in physical contact with. The bonding agent that's most prevalent in the male brain is called vasopressin. In this case, the scientist explains to us the following. Quote, vasopressin seems to have two primary functions related to relationships. Bonding of the man to his mate and attachment to his offspring. Vasopressin seems to be the primary cause of men attaching to women with whom they have had close and intimate physical contact with. However, when men and women decide to have sex with multiple partners, they begin to lose their ability to bond with a partner, which is why promiscuous people have a far harder time staying in a long-term relationship. There's always the running jokes that people in Hollywood and in the culture are getting divorced every couple of weeks. Well, the fact is that if you live a promiscuous lifestyle, your ability to actually bond with your partner and create a meaningful relationship becomes drastically reduced. So there's actually biological realities behind these phenomena that we read about in the media. And what's behind these phenomena is very simply that God created us to be monogamous, God created a natural order surrounding sex, and when we've decided to abandon that natural order and do things our own way, these consequences continue to happen. There's often sort, and we wanted to address this because I had a discussion in Alberta with a number of teachers on this, that there's a boys will be boys attitude simply because they think that when people are young, they're going to go out, they're going to sow their wild oats, but later on they'll settle down and they'll become good and they'll become respectable. Now, this isn't just wrong from the perspective of the fact that young people need guidance and they need their parents to talk to them about these kinds of things so that they can avoid sinful behaviors. This is also even more negligent simply for the reason that if people are running around and sleeping with multiple partners, what they're essentially doing is reducing their chances of having a meaningful and lasting marriage afterwards. The consequences are far too significant to be ignored, and the consequences are far too significant to avoid talking to young people about. So to go briefly through a few of the mental health ramifications of promiscuity, statistics tell us the following things. Sexually active teens are, quote, 3 times more likely to suffer from depression if they are girls, 2 times more likely to experience depression if they are boys. They are 3 times more likely to have attempted suicide if they are girls, and 7 times more likely if they are boys. And the final one that I think is probably the scariest is they are far more likely to divorce if they do get married. All available polling data shows us that those people who marry as virgins have an enormously higher chance of having a successful marriage than those who do not wait for marriage. If people have had one sexual partner on only one, there is also a very, very high chance that that marriage, statistically speaking, of course, will be successful. But today's cultural pattern is, at this point, hook up, shack up, and then break up. And unfortunately, as I mentioned previously, the people that suffer from this are the kids. They're only kids now, but they're going to be the next generation in a few short decades, and we're going to be dealing with a broken culture that has no idea what a real and meaningful family even looks like. Now to briefly recap the presentation that I gave last time I was here on pornography and the impact pornography has. Now what I explained was that pornography is so extraordinarily prevalent today in North America because of its accessibility, its availability, and the fact that it's free. Well over 82% of at least men are using porn at least once a month. Which means, according to the polling data, if you're not using pornography in this day and age, you are a minority in this culture. But it also means that this is a problem very much from inside our culture and something that we have to be fighting within the church, not just trying to keep out. And I received an email since I did the last presentation. And last time I was here, I shared a number of testimonies of people from inside the Netherlands Reformed communities who had struggled with pornography. And I received an email from a woman who only identified herself as a wife of the NRC Norwich Church. And in her letter, she describes how she and her husband struggled with his porn addiction and how, with God's help, they made their marriage work. But she said she wanted to say 2 things. She said, "The reason I am writing this letter is because I know that a lot of women think exactly the same thing I used to think, and that's that my husband will never look at stuff like that. The truth is that most men probably find it hard not to look because of how their brains are wired. I would want to tell all women tonight, I beg you, don't make the same mistake I did. Please install a filter and please make sure you get an accountability report. And most important, talk to each other and pray your marriage is worth it." So that's just what one woman who struggled with this inside our congregations wanted to share with the audience tonight. And I really want to emphasize, because I don't think I emphasized it enough last time, that a filter for your internet really isn't good enough. Because the person who installs the filter on the internet knows how to bypass it, knows how to shut it off. For parents, generally speaking, your kids are a lot more savvy with computers than you are, and they can probably figure out a way around the filter in 15 or 20 minutes. An accountability report isn't necessarily a filter, but what it does is you install it on your computer, and once a week, it sends the internet search history to somebody you've previously selected to be your accountability partner. Which basically means that even if you've decided to look at pornography, even if you've decided to look at really wicked things online, your accountability partner will receive an email with your internet search history in it and will be able to phone you up and hold you accountable. This has worked very successfully for a number of people I know who struggled long and hard to break their porn addictions, but only managed to do it when they knew, when they got on their computer, that literally somebody was looking over their shoulder. Because if they clicked on something, that was going to be sent to their accountability partner in a few days, and that person would call them if they'd messed up. Pornography today in North America, just to recap for those of you who weren't here last time, is a $60 billion a year industry, and that's literally growing by the week. The vast majority of pornography at this point on young people is accessed on mobile devices. It's accessed on Android phones, it's accessed on iPhones, and it's accessed on iPads. So if your kids want to look at porn at your house, they're probably not going to log onto the family computer. They're probably going to be watching it on their phone in their bedrooms or somewhere else. And I know that to be true because I've had people contact me from Netherlands Reformed schools around the country where they say the guys talk about the fact that they're watching porn on their phone and they're watching it all the time. You can get a very cheap data plan now. It's easily available. So it's something that we should just be watching out for. The reason that pornography is as dangerous as it is because it produces something called erototoxins. These erototoxins fire off when a man gets aroused looking at pornography, and it literally begins to rewire your brain. It creates neural pathways in the brain that did not exist prior to viewing pornography. And this is one of the reasons that it's so addictive, because in order to defeat a pornography addiction, these neural pathways in your brain literally have to become overgrown, metaphorically speaking. But once they're there forever. Those pathways cannot be removed. So when you're considering looking at a pornographic image, and this is what I always tell to the young people, don't ask yourself if you want to see that picture right now, because the answer is probably going to be yes. Ask yourself if you still want to see that image when you're 80 years old, because it's still going to be in your brain, burned into your brain. Those neural pathways have to be overgrown, but they can never be destroyed. So pornography, one of the reasons it's so dangerous is quite simply because it's permanent. It's one of those addictions that never quite goes away. It's something that people always have to be vigilant about, and the images that were there remain there. I'm not going to belabor that one too much further because I went through a lot of the consequences last time, but the one thing I really did forget to say last time is the accountability filters are the best filters. Sign up for them, and then your internet history will get sent to somebody who will hold you accountable. Lakita Garth is a very famous abstinence speaker, and the reason I pull this slide up is because I want to share with you something I read in a book that she wrote. She travels around the United States explaining to kids that they should wait to have sex. And she engaged in a conversation with a university student very similar to one I myself had multiple times throughout my 4 years in university. Her roommate said to her, "Don't you feel like you're missing out on anything?" when she discovered that her friend Lakita was not having sex. Lakita replied the following quote, "I have missed out. I have missed out on the thrill of waking up wondering if my early pregnancy test will turn blue. I missed out on not getting to walk into a clinic with my best friend holding my hand because my boyfriend's not taking me there unless he's dragging me in. I missed out on sharing the same joy as my ex-roommate who has pinpointed to the day her child would have been born if she had not had him aborted, and who cries herself to sleep every year because she's named him and celebrates his birthday. I'm even more saddened that 5 years from now, I'll miss out on waking up to stare at the ceiling of an AIDS hospice like my cousin Ricky and my friend Rod before they died. You're right, I have missed out on all the wonderful opportunities you've opened yourselves out for." So in a very spiritual sense, sex can literally destroy everything you hold dear in your life. It can destroy your marriage, it can destroy your church life, it can destroy your relationship with your kids, and it can actually destroy your own brain. Neural pathways put in place by pornography can never be gotten rid of, and I can't emphasize that enough. When you look at the culture that the sexual revolution has given to us, it's really quite insane that we have to defend ourselves in the public square. Many people are nervous about talking about things like abstinence and chastity and being opposed to gay marriage and being opposed to abortion because they think we sound like we're crazy radical Christians and therefore people are going to look at us weird. But if you really think about it for a moment, we believe two people get married, they only have sex when they're married, they have kids, they don't kill their kids. How crazy does that sound to you? The fact that what I just said is now considered to be abnormal, and the fact that people who advocate for that are considered to be abnormal is ludicrous, and I think we need to arm ourselves with the arguments to say to people and to say to the young people, our way is the best way, and it's the best way because it's God's way, and God created the natural order, and if we defy the natural order, we will suffer the consequences in many different ways. So just briefly, I've painted you what might have looked like a fairly nihilistic picture of what the hookup culture looks like in the culture at large. But as always, there's always a positive on the flip side. Now, I've mentioned several times that all polling data shows that those who have the most successful marriages are those who waited to have sex until marriage. These polls keep on coming out, and secular journalists keep on getting shocked. Journalists in Time Magazine, Life Magazine, Newsweek Magazine, because poll after poll after poll comes out and says that those who are religious, those who attend church together, they have by far the most satisfying marital intimacy of any group polled. In other words, all these disgusting and filthy magazines that are being peddled in the stores talking about how you can have better sex are ignoring the very obvious answer. Is it stop doing it the way the world has told you to do it since 1963 and wait for inside of marriage, because it's genuinely the best way and it's genuinely the healthiest way. So just to recap briefly, sexual relations outside of marriage are dangerous for three main reasons, and that's physically, psychologically, and spiritually. It's extremely devastating, but the information is out there, and I want to end on a brief note of encouragement. After I did the presentation at the Rehoboth School, a lot of the young kids contacted me afterwards, said they were so happy to get the information, and a lot of them said it helped to change their mind on a lot of things they thought. So I really think that if young people are equipped with this information and explained exactly why the Christian way is the objectively best way, I think that they'll respond, because I think the science and I think the information very much speaks for itself. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Mr. Heike.
Well, thank you very much, Jonathan. I know when he presented here to our student body, he expressed the intimidation that he felt, and I was really very thankful that he visited, and it definitely did speak to our youth, and I hope it's spoken to all of us this evening, and that we're going to consider our ways and be wise. We have a lot of work to do to stand and to teach and to model in a world that is running against us. Anyway, I'm not to speak, but you have an opportunity for coffee, you have an opportunity for some cookies and drinks and talking for a few minutes. In 10 minutes, I'm going to make an announcement so that in only maybe 1 or 2 minutes after that announcement, you're going to be seated. There is a box back over there, which if you have a paper and you've written a question down, you may drop in there. If you want to ask a question from the floor, you're going to take questions from the floor? We'll take questions from the floor. Reverend Huck Ford and Jonathan and myself will be here for some questions, or if there's any that need to be answered. So, coffee time.
Hands on the dot.
Good.
Is this slower to start?
Yeah, definitely.
That's recorded, so